So, you know, what do we mean when we talk about advocacy? And I just went like this, and our hands, you know, are so important to us. And, you know, the devotions from this morning in terms from Henry Nouwen and what our hands do, for those of you that were there in Holden Hotel to hear that in the cafeteria. And the ELCA's motto is our hands, God's work. And the hands, our hands are the hands of advocacy, and we are all God's advocates. You know, no matter what our title is, the name of our church or the denomination or a religious affiliation, we are all God's advocates. And an advocate is one who does, you know, what God calls them to do in the midst of where they live, helping a neighbor in need. And it can be through our hands of advocacy. You know, the most common one that religious people that have done throughout the centuries is what we would call the hand of compassion, the hand of charity. You know, when there's someone in need, an individual, we help that person. You know, either through listening ears, through our hands, with whatever it might be, good, with a shelter, with canned food. But then the other hand of advocacy, which is where Lutheran public policy comes in, no matter what our religious affiliation is across this country, all religious organizations use this other hand, the hand of justice. The hand that in Lutheran tradition asks the question, we all ask that question because it's an age-old question, what does this mean? What does this mean that this hand has what is known as compassion fatigue? It goes down like this, and this, and this, and this, right? It gets tired. And it looks constantly for others to help. And there's constantly the lines at our food banks, at emergency shelters, at domestic violence shelters. Are the lines going down in any of those places that you've heard of? If they are, I'd like to know where you live. But the hand of justice says, what does this mean that those lines are still long? And asks and gets into the systems of our society, the structures of our world. Or as we've probably heard a lot, okay, so the hand of compassion helps try and bring bodies out of the river before they're drowning or as they're drowning. But the hand of justice asks, so why are their bodies still in the stream? Why are their bodies still floating down? And so as I think of that image, I think of some examples from Scripture, from the Jewish Scriptures and from the Christian Scriptures. You know, Moses was saved in the river. I'm a preacher, so it's terrible. You know, you got the whole symbolism of the river of life, the tree of life, from the book of Revelation. But Moses, and we all know the story, you know, I would suspect that most of us know the story of Moses. And it's one of the most beautiful, it's still one of the most powerful, it's probably overused, but it's, you know, Exodus chapter 3, some things are just, you know, are just everlasting. Where the writer of Exodus depicts God as the advocate. You know, the one who sees the oppression, who hears the cries of the Israelites, and who senses from his heart. And so what does he do then? What does God do? Does God just, you know, magically appear and bingo, it's over with, all everything's taken care of? No, he calls an ordinary human being. And there we can take Moses' name out and put in our name. You know, from the Lutheran tradition, Martin Luther always said that we are to be little Christ. And we all know that even as dismal as we might feel coming in about how we feel about the mood, what our mood might be about the country in which we live, you know, Moses came back, and we all know, knowing the story of Moses, he, just like Jonah, you know, he didn't want to come back, right? Life was going pretty well for him. But he went back. And as he went back, he knew where he was going to have to go. He went back not with his, you know, and I'm not knocking at all Lutheran World Relief or whatever the denomination is, that, you know, whatever you're doing in your denomination in terms of the quilts or a canned good. But he went back and he used the part of his, the part of his body that gets all of us into trouble, right? God called him to speak the truth to power. And of course, we all know that he just went down that hall of power once, and because, you know, God was on his side, right? Mm-hmm. Moses was righted into Egypt, whatever the capital of Egypt was, wherever the Pharaoh was sitting on his white horse, and, you know, Pharaoh, you don't listen to me, right? I mean, after all, I do now know where I came from. I came from the king's court. And it took how many times?
Several times.
And about ten.
So there's we can get into that whole analysis. We're not going to do that. But yeah. But the fact of the matter is, it takes many times, and so we're called to be God's faithful advocates. So that's just a real quick kind of scriptural piece that, you know, we can add in from any of our denomination religious huge traditions that we've got. We can go to the prophets. You go to, you know, obviously Jesus has something to say about it as well. Wherever you want to go with that, Luke 4, his first address addressed, you know, the systems in terms of poverty and those who are in prison. All the four Gospels talk about his journey, and oftentimes he went to different places, but in each of the Gospels, he ended up in which town in Jerusalem, in Israel? I just said it again.
Jerusalem.
Yeah, Jerusalem was what did that city have as different of all the other ones? There was a lot of power there. Within the Jewish hierarchy and structure, and of course, the Roman structure was all there. And Jesus spoke to that power. So that, I think, is I don't know if we want to open it up for any questions right there. I'm going to keep moving us along, but I wanted to at least lay that foundation piece for kind of the scriptural and theological. I mean, our sacraments are full of advocacy. You know, as we go forward in terms of communion, we go forward to meet the advocate. The waters of baptism call us to be God's advocate. And in terms of our Lutheran tradition, you know, there was Martin Luther in the 16th century writing all kinds of letters, hundreds of letters. I'd still, before I die, would like to see just a pamphlet, you know, Carol and other religious leaders and anyone in this room, just a pamphlet, just on the letters that he wrote, you know, and the issues that he addressed of his day. So, any thoughts, any comments about questions about the theological, scriptural, quote, rationale, motivation, calling for us to be God's advocates, particularly in the political realm? So keep in mind, as I describe the two hands of advocacy, you know, the hand that I'm about is urging people of faith to enter into that intersection. The intersection, whether it be the cross or whatever intersection we want to call it, the intersection of faith and the political. Go ahead, John.
So are you saying that it takes someone who has had power to speak truth to power?
I really don't believe that. I don't believe that at all. You know, a lot of folks a lot of my colleagues and others talk about that they're the voice for the voiceless. I don't believe that anyone's voiceless. I really don't. I believe that that all of us, a lot of us in privileged positions in life, I'll just speak for myself, can oftentimes learn so much from other voices. And to learn from them as to the structures under which they live and try and survive. And so important in my mind, as you look through human history and those that led reform efforts, you know, oftentimes always included in leadership positions people that were not on the high, not to use the ladder, but I'll just use it for these purposes, not up on the high rung of the ladder, but oftentimes as society, through society's eyes, on the bottom rung. So think what I want to do is just kind of go into the brochures that we've got before us, and then a little bit about the ELCA structure. If you don't have the brochure, but it's basically it is the Lutheran Public Policy Office one, but it is so much like other denominations. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America and the Roman Catholic Church are the two Christian denominations that have state policy offices that actually fund state policy offices. There's about 38 state Catholic conference offices, and there's about 18 in the ELCA. Here in Washington State, we work across denominational and interfaith-wise, and are not just at the state legislative level, because if any of us know, as citizens of this country, there is not many state issues that don't intersect at the federal level or vice versa, and sometimes even down to the local level. So Lutheran Public Policy has been around for about 25 years. It's about when the Lutheran Church started to form state public policy offices, and we are a resource for congregations of this state. We're really happy to work with our UCC congregations in our state, as well as Methodist and Episcopal, and have great relationships with some of our Jewish friends as well. So that is, I think, but and in the brochure as well, you'll see the our core values as you open it up, and as you open it up all the way, you'll see for ELCA folks, our social statements. Or from left to right, you'll see, first of all, the various levels of our advocacy ministry, from the United Nations, where UCC, Presbyterians, Jewish faith has representation, all denominations, all religious organizations, all the NGOs, non-governmental organizations. And then our ELCA social statements, which many religious organizations have some kind of social policy. Our legislative agenda, which covers many issues and policy areas, and then our advocating congregations program is the last column. If you have your brochure all the way open, because oftentimes that's one reason why I wanted us to identify what our local, where's our local worshiping community at. And so the advocating congregations, and how do we do advocacy at the local level? So there's Paul and others, that go about doing this kind of work. But is John?
Yes.
As you mentioned, I mean, it's all of our voices. If all of our voices aren't operating like Moses was, and I kind of think that maybe, even though the scripture only talks about Moses, I suspect that there might have been a few others that were there advocating along with Moses. And the prophets know that only as one voice, they too knew that it was important to have other voices working with them. So I'm going to hand out our advocating congregations program that we're starting to work on. And this is really an effort to get local worshiping congregations to sign up to consider what does it mean to be an advocating congregation, and we kind of like to believe that all congregations, again, no matter what the denominational affiliation is an advocating congregation, and because all congregations do some form of advocacy, whether it be the hand of compassion or whether it be the hand of justice. So this is our effort here in Washington State to engage at the congregational level. And an advocating congregation, so the green sheet is kind of the summary of the covenant. The graphic side is kind of what the congregation will do. The great graphic from the common ordinary Dan Erlander of Holden Village fame, And then on the backside is kind of what LPPO will do, so this is kind of like a covenant relationship. And the 8.5 by 11 sheet is kind of an FAQ, frequently asked questions. So does this mean that if we quote sign up to be an advocating congregation, a part of the statewide network of advocating congregations, does that mean that we, as a congregation, you know, sign up for all the positions that LPPO takes in the Washington State Legislature or on initiatives? No. You know, does it mean that, gosh, you got to sign up for $100 per member to LPPO? You're supposed to laugh at that. To build this great financial empire that Paul Benz wants to build? No. You know, so it's, but an advocating congregation is a congregation that says yes to urging its members in the midst of the political diversity of any congregation. And there should all be a loud amen for better or for worse that there is political diversity in our congregation from A to Z, or you know, Democrat, Republican, and anything in between. Then in the midst of that diversity on the critical issues of our day, the congregation says yes to its members using their voice in the halls of power. And that they see that as a fundamental connection to their faith. You know, for us as Lutherans and many other denominations, it stems out of our baptismal vocation. You know, we can go over to the community center, get our Lutheran book of worship out, turn to the page where it says to strive for justice and peace throughout all the earth, as a part of our rite of confirmation, as a part of our baptismal services. It's part of who we are. And striving for justice and peace, yes, means the hand of justice. We don't have extrapolation of each of those little phrases, but that is, at least in my mind, is what that involves. So that's a little bit on the advocating congregations and what an advocating congregation is. And we'll take up an offering of letters. Wherever there's an offering of letters, there's always suggested letters, which I'm going to have at the end of our time together, but there's always a blank piece of paper. You know, I think this, dear Senator Murray, I think this Lutheran Public Policy Office is a, I'm not going to add that, is a, but, you know, bunch of baloney. Or I'm taking a position other than what many in this congregation is taking. That's the diversity in which we live and struggle and strive with. So I'm just going to pause there and just, you know, see if you have any, because now we're going to shift into what some of the current federal issues is. Give Linda a little bit of time about domestic violence, talk about some of the ballot issues on Washington State, and then we're going to move out of here and see if anybody wants to do any letter writing. So, questions?
Would you talk a little bit about tax status? Congregations I've been part of have been reticent to take up issues. I know, or my understanding is, you can have positions on issues but not candidates.
That's correct.
There seems to be some reticence around.
We encourage congregations, as I understand through my experience of IRS and experience of congregations when they do enter into this realm, that taking, and you have to define what does it mean for a congregation to take a position. You know, seldom will there's nothing wrong with a congregation doing an offering of letters. Nothing, I mean, congregations have been doing that in this country for decades. So there is nothing at all wrong with that. There is as well nothing wrong for a congregation to do a candidates forum right in their own sanctuary. Now it can't be I'll just use our own context, literally the context right here. So Holden Village is, or say Fullness of God is the congregation, they're in the 4th Congressional District. I believe it's the 4th. And Representative Doc Hastings is their congressional rep. I know Carol might have some indigestion over this, but so that they could have a forum here, a candidates forum, and only invite Doc Hastings. Then they might get into trouble. There might be probably other reasons why the Fullness of God congregation might get into trouble with IRS. But So, so you know what I mean? I mean, if you're gonna have a candidates forum, it's gotta be all the candidates at least invited. And actually, religious organizations, if a congregation could be that like-minded enough on any of the initiatives that, that are on a ballot in any state, those states that are, that do have an initiative process, not all the states in this country have an initiative process. I'd like to, you know, sometimes move to that state, but. Yeah, it, well, it's not Oregon. I don't know if Wisconsin, is, I think Wisconsin's not. Wisconsin, Minnesota, some of those upper Midwest states have it right sometimes. You know, they're not an initiative state, I don't think, no. So, but you can take a position on initiatives. So, Lutheran Public Policy does, Lutheran Community Services Northwest could if they wanted to. The Children's Alliance, which is a huge children's advocacy organization in the state, the domestic violence organization that, that Linda works for example, could as well. So it's just whether or not they want to venture into that. So, any other comments or questions at this time?
What about the national issues?
Yeah. So let's. Well, why don't we get into that? And there's about three that I'm going to touch on real quickly, and then I'm going to turn it over to Linda for domestic violence before we get into some of the Washington State ballot measures. So the three that LPPO are working on, and obviously this is federal issues that, that cover anybody here, is this year, as you know, our Congress reauthorizes certain policy issues, right? So like the Farm Bill, for example, or as some say it should be called the Food Bill, is reauthorized every 5-6 years. And this year, what is up is the reauthorization of our about 8 or 9 child nutrition programs. So, for example, we're in the right in the throes of summer. One of the important child nutrition programs is our summer meal programs, which is oftentimes can be USDA food coming through and monitored by a school district, but oftentimes more so not school districts anymore because it's the time where a school district takes off, but some schools still do remain involved in the summer meal program. But it can be a nonprofit, a food nonprofit. It could even be a church. So if your church, for example, the Port Angeles Holy Trinity Lutheran Church, there was a couple of terrific, amazing women that said, you know, we don't have a summer meal site here in Port Angeles anymore. No, we don't, do we? Well, I think we ought to get one going. And so 2 or 3 women, you know, worked with the state and LPPO, and now there's a summer meal site, and they can move it from, you know, one church says, hey, we're going to take it in 2009, because Port Angeles is a relatively small community, and we're going to take it next year. And it's a great way. That's the site, and they do the advertisement. And they work through all the paperwork, but it's a great way. So, what is being reauthorized in when things are up in Congress is what level of funding? How are the programs going to be reformed? And what is the evaluation of the effectiveness of these programs? And this so that this reauthorization process has been going through the Senate and the House. Literally as we speak, and we've got a suggested form letter for you to handwrite later on, but that's one of the programs, one of the issues before Congress that we're urging people to write to their senators or local congressional reps saying, please, and the funding level that we're urging is $1 billion per year. I know it sounds like, oh my gosh, but that's what we're urging. All of these are kind of anti-poverty programs, is the EITC and the CTC. EITC is the Earned Income Tax Credit, long-standing anti-poverty program, federal program in this country. We're asking for an extension and strengthening of that, as simple as that. Bread for the World, that's many of you know. How many know Bread for the World? Very good, long time, 30, 40 year old. anti-poverty organization started by a Missouri Synod Lutheran pastor in New York City, the brother of the great senator who was here just a few years ago, Paul Simon, and unfortunately is not with us anymore, but is the angel watching over us, encouraging us literally here today, as well as Wes Breed. Because you know how Holden Village came into being, right? Huh?
No.
Handwritten letter. Someone saying, I'm going to make a difference. I'm going to try and make a difference. I mean, you could almost say it was Moses-esque, so to speak. And when I didn't get a response, oh, well, I should have listened to the other ones. What good does a letter do? And Wes kept writing and writing. And same way with all the people, Bread for the World and others. So child nutrition, earned income tax credit, CTC is the child tax credit. All those help provide a tax credit for the very lowest income of households around our country and help raise people out of poverty. So I think, Linda, I'm just going to, the other critical one that is called the FMAP, the Federal Medical Assistance Percentage Program, FMAP. 47 states, and Congress is going to be recessing in about 2 weeks, August 9th. That's even less than 2 weeks, but whatever it is. And right now, literally, Congress is, at the last week of July, still in session, wrestling with whether or not there will be a six-month extension. 47 states are calling for extra assistance out of this program to help low-income people with medical services. 30 states banked it in because states have to balance their budgets. 30 of our 50 states banked it, meaning that's the means by which they help balance their budget, because there's not a state except North Dakota. There's nobody here from North Dakota that I think is in arrears, meaning revenue is not matching spending government programs in their state. Washington State was at about a $2 billion revenue shortfall. Coming into next session, next January, they'll be at a $3 billion shortfall. For Washington State, the FMAP monies mean about $480 million, almost a half a billion. If we don't get that, the governor may call us into special session. Other governors may do that as well. It all depends upon what their state process is. So that's the FMAP. So I've got a letter there, suggested letter, form letter for that as well, which you can write on. And if you're from another state, I've got all the books here from your the addresses and all that stuff. So I'm going to zip it and let Linda talk about it.
And this isn't the broader domestic violence, this is as it relates to legislative issues. And I've done domestic violence work for over 25 years in Kentucky and Washington State, and currently I work at the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence, specifically as their housing program coordinator and public policy specialist. So the two things in particular that are pressing in Washington, D.C., the Family Violence Prevention and Services Act. That was first passed in 1984. It's been renewed, reauthorized several times. It expired a couple of years ago, and it needs to be reauthorized again. It is a critical act. It was the act that initially pumped money nationwide into battered women's shelters and programs. In Washington State, extremely critical for the shelter structure. And the reauthorization is something we've been pushing for a couple of years. Anyone from Wisconsin has been hearing me sing the praises of Representative Gwen Moore of Milwaukee. She is the person who has brought forward the whole Reauthorization Act. She is a survivor of domestic violence. She has been playing a leadership role in the national network to end domestic violence, and especially guidance to women of color in leadership roles, again, as they work against violence for all of us, any of us, and our families. So that reauthorization is critical. It's in the House. We are working to get it going in the Senate also, but we would like to see it passed by the end of this year. Without the reauthorization, the money that goes with it is always at jeopardy. If you don't have an act that is current and active and moving, then anything you budget for the budget can contribute to this. And if you're moving into the budgetary issues, of course, the issue of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, across the country, dating violence, all of those budgetary things are tied up, of course, with the Family Violence Prevention and Services Act, as well as the Violence Against Women Act. And there are some critical components, and what we are hoping for is that the Senate and the House will authorize at least the amount of money that President Obama has put into his budget for domestic, dating, sexual assault, and stalking services, prevention, all of the issues that, that again, support our programs nationwide. And ultimately, I hope, move to a place of prevention. That is our goal. And a piece of the Family Violence, Family Women's, Violence Against Women Act is transitional housing. I would also say related to housing, that survivors of domestic violence make up, the women and children make up 80% of the homeless families in the country. That was just a recent U.S. Conference of Mayors report that came out. So we care very much about housing for survivors of domestic violence, and not only in the Violence Against Women Act provision, but also if any of you are familiar with McKinney-Vento and the Hearth Reauthorization Act for McKinney-Vento. Again, it's money, and I know budgeting is tight, but I would just really hope that we don't balance the budget on the backs of people who are poor and vulnerable and need a roof over their heads and supportive services to help keep them there. So finally, just wrapping up, this is an odd little quirky, he's got the cards. But this thing called the Pepsi Refresh Challenge, and this is the teams, the baseball teams that Pepsi has, you know, kind of like vendor agreements with, 15 of them. Each team chooses a special issue area, a charity. And then they go with that issue, the partners, for a period of about 3-4 weeks, and people vote. You don't have to send a dime. All it needs is a few minutes of your time to vote either by your cell phone or your computer. And in Washington State, what the Mariners chose was the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence to do a project called Coaching Boys into Men. And, you know, as we talk about all of the services for domestic violence, there is very little out there to prevent violence in families. And I think we all ask, how can we just stop it from happening in the first place? So this is a critical initiative that for $200,000, my state coalition will be working on this and doing a program where coaches are supported in mentoring the young athletes into respectful relationships with their teammates and their community, with women, and hopefully prevent some of the family violence that we often see and hear about. This is something that is often nationwide. It started in San Francisco. One of my favorite Jewish authors, Jackson Katz, as a matter of fact, is a huge proponent of coaching boys into men and preventing family violence. So, if you've got time and inclination, I would encourage you to go ahead and check out the website. And if one of the 14 teams, other 14 teams, you know, do something wonderful for you, you can vote as much as you like, and you can vote for all of them if you'd like. But certainly the idea of preventing domestic violence, in addition to your support legislatively for those people impacted by it right now, would be appreciated.
If I put this on Facebook, will a link pop up?
Yes, well, it should.
I can send it on Facebook.
Yep, Facebook, Twitter, I guess. I'm not skilled with that, but absolutely, it is supposed to.
Great, Linda. We all know there are just you know, it's if you've been involved as an advocate, you know, in terms of the political realm, you know how the critical issues are just overwhelming, and I think you have to pick that one or two throughout the seasons, you know, of the year and of your life that are really resonate with you. And if you're a multitasker, hey, then you can, you know, take on three or four. But I think, and as a congregation, you know, as we address congregations, we really urge the congregation to plan out a year. Most congregations of any denomination or faith, you know, kind of start with the school year, right? It's kind of September is, you know, we get the Sunday schools going, all that stuff, the adult education programs. So as you do that, you know, as you don't start that planning in September, obviously, you do it a few months ahead of time. Think through what is the role of advocacy, particularly advocacy in the political realm, where as you do advocacy with the hand of compassion, then as we do that, as we send the quilts off to Lutheran World Relief or to a local DV shelter, what is then the hand of justice type of act that we can then do at the same time? Or as we bring canned goods up to the altar, you know, or collect them, whatever that hand of compassion might be, you know, sending a youth group, you know, to another country to observe poverty there or to work on a Habitat for Humanity building. Then as they come back, what is the poverty look like? What does the housing needs look like in Congress that might impact our local community? So there's all kinds of things, but you have to really be strategic and pick one or two that you can really chew on and hopefully see some results from. Carol?
I've really appreciated the role that LPBO has played in leading people into actually making their views known directly to legislators. Your advocacy day, Interfaith Advocacy Days in Olympia have been really instructive. And I think that direct face-to-face approach can really, I mean, it not only gives that representative your very own position, but it, I think, really encourages little people like me and other people to know that we can have some kind of an impact.
Yep. I thank you for that, Carol. And I know a lot of Wisconsin, Minnesota, again, I'm kind of staying in the Lutheran track here, but all people of all faiths are welcome to these events. It has a state office. Minnesota has a state office. They have an annual state legislative day, you know, so does Wisconsin. I forget where our friend from Florida, you know, we don't have one there, but...
Oregon has an advocacy.
Yeah, in Oregon too, I'm sorry. Yeah, Oregon is here. So there's nothing like, I mean, this is kind of for state legislators, this is not necessarily a dead time, but this is a time when meaning that, you know, because most people think, well, you know, a state legislator's work is really only when the legislature's in session. Well, that's not really true. A state legislator's work constantly goes on during the year. But it's good when a congregation, when an advocacy team from a local congregation say, you know, can call me up or just on their own say, we want to meet with our local state legislator about XYZ issue. It might be about domestic violence, it might be about child nutrition, whatever that is. And that's the best way to really begin to engage the elected official. Because then you can let them know as people of faith, and we're doing this as people of faith. And you can have the eyeball to eyeball, you know. It's a great added value to your witness, to the witness for the church, capital C, when that can be done. You know, it's great to go down during the legislative session. That's very, very important, but it can be at any time during the year. So. And in the next few minutes, we're just going to plow into the November ballot issues for Washington State. Other states are welcome to stay because there's, you know, some of them will be addressing taxation. And I know the 4 o'clock thing is going to be coming in. But if you're leaving and you want to write a letter, we have the sample letters here that you can take. And so please consider that, along with an envelope and a piece of paper. All right, very good, very good, 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 good. Do any, are any of you from Washington State aware of Bill Gates Sr.?
Yes.
Those of you from other states that are staying here have heard about Bill Gates Sr., right?
Right.
So what I'm handing out is not the profile of Bill Gates Sr., but is a summary from a network of a coalition of 50 to 60 organizations that Lutheran Public Policy Office will probably soon be joining. But this is summaries of the ballot measures. And then I should add these as well. So what we're going to do is go through what some of them are. 1098, and this one that's coming out now, is specifically about initiative 1098. That is the one associated with Bill Gates Sr. And the reason I mentioned Bill is about the issue of leadership. And it is wonderful on this particular issue when a person of wealth, a person of great wealth, can come and speak publicly about his viewpoint on tax reform and the need for it. Washington State has the most regressive tax structure for local and state taxes in the country. And I minored in economics. I'm not going to go into a great economic analysis, but basically, a regressive tax structure means that a person of higher wealth pays less into the state and local treasuries than a person of lower income. That's basically a regressivity in about two sentences.
Less in terms of percentage or less in terms of gross amount?
In terms of percentage. So, or better put, proportion. What is the proportion that a person of lower wealth or lower income pays than a person of greater income? So that's usually how progressivity and regressivity is measured in by economists in terms of tax structures. So 1098, initiative 1098, is an attempt by Bill Gates Sr. and others to reform a regressive tax structure in our state to being more progressive. And the basic means of doing that, what this would literally do, so this would create a state law that would institute a tax on income, on household income, for single earners beginning at the $200,000 level, and for couples or partnerships, as we call them in Washington State, for same-gender partnerships at the $400,000 level. And I believe that the tax rate is between 4% and 5%. So that's what the 1098, if asked by 51% of the voters, would do. That's a part of it. The other tax reform in this is that then it stays the same from that level, the $200,000-$400,000 level, and when an earner earns the $1 million level, so from 6-digit to 7-digit, then the tax rate almost doubles, from between 4% and 5% to between 9% and 10%. The State Department of Revenue in Washington State has estimated that what this and the Governor's Budget Office estimates that what this would bring in is around $1 billion on a calendar year. Oh, and we've got to get out of here. So so that is basically what 1098 would do. Let me just run through the others real quickly. 1053, initiative 1053 is one by Tim Iman. And for those of you that live here in Washington State, you know who Tim Iman is. He's the anti-tax person. And that would require, in my mind, an undemocratic way of for the state legislature to approve taxes. And it would approve it, it'd have to be a two-thirds vote on any tax increase or any fee increase. 1082, there's several privatization measures on the ballot. One is 1082, which would privatize our workers' comp issue. And that is people that companies that are helping with that are companies like AIG. Anybody remember hearing of AIG? So oftentimes in these initiatives, you need to figure out who are the people backing that. Referendum 52 is not an initiative, but it's a referendum coming from the state legislature. Would by the sale of bonds in this state help retrofit our existing and old schools? So it would be a it's an environmentally clean type of referendum. So basically, Luther Public Policy is urging a yes vote on Initiative 1098, the one on tax reform, a no vote on the privatization on 1082, which is the privatization of the workers' comp, and a no vote on 1107, which is the repeal of taxes on three-year temporary tax increase on soda pop, candy, gum, and water. We're saying no to that. The American Beverage Association just happens to be a prime funder of that. I can't understand why, right? And we are also encouraging a no vote on another privatization issue, and that's 1105 and 1100. So just in about 3 minutes, we went through all of them. 1105 and 1100 is brought to you by Costco and other corporations that want a finger in the selling of hard liquor. And our state happens to be a state that has a liquor control board where there are only currently 300 outlets, and this measure, if approved, could open up over 3,000 outlets in our state.
What would it cost the budget for the state?
And very good, Mary Alice. It would cost the state budget about between roughly $300 million a year.
Can we maybe in the Creekside?
Yes, we're going to move to Creekside for those of you that would like to continue.